This is Global Torah Live, conversations and meditations on global Jewish service and international development. I'm your host, Shani Rosenbaum. Today, we bring you a challenging and uplifting conversation between Rabbi Jenny Rosen, Vice President for Community Engagement at HIAS, and Carol Stern, Executive Director of U.S. Funds for UNICEF. Their discussion was recorded before a live audience at Olam's 2017 Focal Point Conference.
Hi, I'm Aaron Dorfman. I'm the president of Lippman Canfor Foundation for Living Torah. And our focus is on helping Jews and fellow travelers apply Jewish wisdom to live better lives and shape a better world, which feels like it's squarely in the center of global Jewish service. And so I'm really honored to be here and honored to have been asked to moderate this closing panel with Carol Stern, President and CEO of UNICEF USA, and Rabbi Jenny Rosen, Vice President for Community Engagement at HIAS. I'm going to give them a chance to introduce themselves in a couple of minutes and just give you a little bit of framing. First, I want to acknowledge, I feel like we're a little bit of that the classic New Yorker cover, right? We're in this fairly international room, and the three of us either live on or within spitting distance of the island of Manhattan. So that gives us you know, a certain measure of myopia or whatever. But I think it's a useful thing to acknowledge in a room and in a space where we're talking about global challenges, and should give us all a moment to think about, you know, who's not here. Right? Who are the beneficiaries of our work in the global South and developing world who aren't here? What perspectives should we always be trying to bring into rooms like this? So I just wanted to name that. So I've got a few questions that I'm going to ask Jenny and Carol, and then we're going to try to save a good chunk of time at the end to open the conversation up to all of you. So first off, I'd like to invite each of you to take a few minutes to introduce yourselves, talk a little bit about your organizations, and share also a specific story that gives you particular hope about Jewish communal involvement in global issues.
I think we have these.
Yeah. Are you on your mic there? Okay, great.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here. And HIAS, where I work, is such a proud member of Olam, so thank you. So my life as a rabbi has really been dedicated to engaging the American Jewish community in issues of social and economic justice. So I started as a Hillel rabbi at Columbia Barnard Hillel. I then worked at the Nathan Cummings Foundation for almost a decade, building the sector of Jewish social justice. And I came to HIAS about 4 years ago to serve as the Vice President for Community Engagement to really build a strategy and a movement of Jews for refugees. HIAS, as some of you may know by our former name, Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, and we are a 136-year-old Jewish organization in support of refugees. We're rooted in Jewish values. Many of us think about as the sort of framing story of our people, our own exodus from Egypt, and the refrain over and over again throughout the Torah, that we should protect the stranger, welcome the stranger, even love the stranger. Why? It's actually one of the mitzvot that we're given a reason for, which is not true for all of them. Ki gerim haitem be'eretz Mitzrayim, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. But it's also our history, and our history of having been refugees over and over and over again throughout time. And it's really in our DNA, I think, as a people. So because this has been our story, HIAS exists, we have welcomed and resettled waves of Jews who came to this country, primarily helping them resettle here. And for the first 120 years, we rescued and resettled Jewish refugees. And then after the last wave of Soviet Jews came to this country, at the turn of this century, we really had a choice to make as an organization. Should we close up shop? Mission accomplished. There are virtually no Jews in captivity. Or should we take our relationships and our experience and our expertise and work with people who are fleeing violence and persecution today? And today we work with refugees of all ethnic and religious backgrounds. We like to say that we used to help refugees because they were Jewish, and now we help refugees because we're Jewish. So what does HIAS do? We do four things. We work internationally. We work in Eurasia, in South America, and in Africa. With refugees who have fled to those countries. The vast majority of refugees will not be resettled in a third country like America or Europe, but have to integrate and make a life for themselves in those countries. And those tend to be among the world's poorest countries. So our staff work in three ways in those countries. We provide legal services to help refugees establish their basic human rights. We provide psychosocial support, because as many of you know, trauma is an experience that a vast majority of refugees have. And then the third area is livelihoods, because you can have your basic human rights, you can begin to heal from trauma, but if you can't support your family in a sustainable way, you can't really have a vibrant and sustainable life with dignity. Second area of work is our domestic resettlement work in this country. So the refugees who come to this country, we work with a network of agencies, mostly Jewish family service agencies across America, helping refugees who come to this country rebuild their lives here. The third piece of our work is advocacy, both sort of government facing from staff and increasingly having built a grassroots network. And then the fourth piece of our work is mobilizing the American Jewish community to act with and on behalf of refugees. So last Tuesday night, June 6th, was the 79th anniversary of the turning back of the St. Louis, when the St. Louis was turned away from our shores here and sent back to Europe. And as we know, for many, that meant being returned to their deaths. And so we catalyzed and supported vigils across the country of Jewish communities holding vigils to recognize the loss of the people on the St. Louis and to call upon elected officials not to repeat this very dark moment in our nation's history. And what gives me hope is that while we catalyzed them and supported them, it was the grassroots and communities that Hayez has built who organized them all. And that is really a reflection of the moment that we're in, which is more need than ever. There are more refugees and displaced people than any other time in recorded history, 65 million, which is a difficult number to fathom. But we're also at a moment, I think, globally and certainly here in America, where people are awake and the Jewish community is mobilized and really taking action. And that gives me hope.
So I almost feel like sitting next to Jenny, it's like my alter ego here, because my route to what I do, Hayez is a part of, and the SS St. Louis is a big part of. I am the child of a child refugee. My mother and her brother were sent to this country at the age of 6 and 4 with neither of their parents, with a woman whose last name they know, but whose first name they will never know. They never saw her again. And she brought them here, and Hayez participated in eventually reuniting her with her family and getting them settled. But her early childhood years were spent in an orphanage here on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And from the moment I heard that story, my mother was constantly pointing out that woman, the woman who she never saw again, and teaching us as kids that one person can indeed make a difference, that without this woman, I would not exist. And so net result, she had us involved in everything, I mean, really everything, while my grandfather, in the meantime, was on the SS St. Louis. He was on the Voyage of the Damned, and he was one of few who did live. And he lived primarily because, for whatever reason, and he never knew why, he was taken off the boat in London when it was refueling and immediately put into a prisoner of war camp because he was an Austrian. And he survived the war because he was an Austrian, which is ironic. But while my mother was teaching us how one person could make a difference, my grandfather was teaching us what happens when the world turns its back and when nobody gives a damn and when people only watch out for their own. And so growing up in this house meant, as I said, my mother had us march on everything. We were part of the civil rights movement. We were part of the voters' rights movement. We were part of the women's rights movement, the gay rights movement. If my mother could paint the sign and you were her kid, you were carrying it. It was just part of life in our house. And so the fact that my brother and I end up in helping professions is really, I don't think we ever had a choice that this is what we would do. But I did start my career in higher ed. I was dean at Polytechnic University, and I was very involved with the race riots that took place in Brooklyn in trying to heal the community, and was very fortunate to be recognized for that work. And the next day, Abe Foxman called me and said, we're starting this anti-bias project called A World of Difference at the ADL. we need a founding director. Would you come and start this project? And so it seemed like my life calling, and I took a sabbatical from being dean with the intent of going for 1 year to establish this amazing campaign. I stayed 18 years. I never went back to being a dean. And then UNICEF called. And I think the most common question I get when I say UNICEF and my name is, what's a nice Jewish girl doing at UNICEF? I can honestly tell you that my initial reactions were very similar, but I can say I do believe that if you save one life, you save the world. And what UNICEF has the glory for is that UNICEF has saved the lives of more children than any other humanitarian organization in the world. And what we do is whatever it takes to save a child anywhere in the world. In 190 countries and territories, 12,000 boots on the ground, food, water, sanitation, education, child protection, HIV response, whatever it is that takes a childhood away from a child, we are there to ensure that that child not only survives, but thrives. We have no politics. The only side we're on is the side of the child. And we have had some great success, and we still have a long way to go. Today, as we enjoy our afternoon, 16,000 children under the age of 5 will die of causes we already know how to prevent. So not the disease we don't have a cure for, or the earthquake I can't predict, but things like diarrhea, lack of water, lack of food, 16,000 yesterday, 16,000 today, 16,000 moms who will not kiss that child good morning tomorrow. And in the 1980s, that number was 35,000. We have halved that number. If I had a product that could show that success, it would be phenomenal. In those ensuing years, the world's population has tripled. So if we had done nothing, theoretically, over 100,000 children would be dying of preventable causes each day. And so I'm really proud of what the organization has to do, and in a very short space, the story I will tell you that gives me hope. One of the first assignments I had when I came to UNICEF was to work in Darfur. I was in the refugee camp. I spent a long afternoon with 25 women who each told me their story, and they kind of started their story by telling me they were raped as if that was a given, and then went into really the horrors of what it was like to watch a village burn down, to watch your children taken, your husband killed, etc. And it was a very, very difficult afternoon. It was my first experience in a refugee camp. And as I was getting ready to leave, one of the more elderly women took me aside, and she was completely wrapped and covered, and she took me aside and she said to me, when you go back to the United States, tell them I know that it's the Americans who are helping, but make sure you tell the people of Abraham we know it's them that is helping us. And I was unbelievably moved. This woman had no idea who I was. She had no idea what my background was. I don't know if she knew I was Jewish or not, but she was aware that it is the people of Abraham who, when we said never again, we meant it. And so that gives me hope. I think you're all here because you believe that, and that's what gives me hope.
Thank you both so much. Great, incredible, incredibly inspiring stories. Both of you hinted at some of the political complexities of your work inside of your organization. So I want to follow up, Carol, with you. You mentioned this, the question of what's a nice Jewish girl doing at the UN. Where does that question emerge for you, and how do you navigate it, given the complex history that the Jewish community and Israel in particular have with the United Nations?
You know, when I first got the call, did I want to come to UNICEF? All of my research and the books I've written have been about children and about making the lives of children complete. So it was a natural phone call on some level. But I was like, what, are you kidding me? You know, the UN, I'm not going there. And I had at my disposal, because I was the chief operating officer at ADL, I had the ADL research department. So I went to them and I said, quite honestly, I got this really interesting call from UNICEF. They want to partner with us. would ADL put its name next to UNICEF's? And I figured they'd give me all the data I needed, and I could go back and tell UNICEF, here's all the reasons I won't work with you. And lo and behold, they came back and they said, yes, ADL will put their name next to UNICEF. What's the project? And then I went, yeah. So in any case, I did go on the interview. I learned quite a bit. I learned that there has been an office in Israel, a UNICEF office in Israel, since almost the inception. It has never closed. It continues today. It was at first a recipient office. When you think of the days of milk and honey, it was UNICEF that supplied the powdered milk. UNICEF also helped in the design of the water plant. Golda Meir declared Israel an industrialized nation, and she went from being a recipient country to a donor country, except obviously in the territories, we are still, it is still a recipient area. When UNICEF was given the Nobel Peace Prize, it was actually the Israel director that accepted and gave the speech on behalf of UNICEF. So there is actually a much longer tradition than I anticipated. But it's still, I would have been happy if it was ISIF. It still had those letters at the beginning that made me uncomfortable. So I went to go see the then ambassador, Danny Ayalon, and I said to him, I want to understand how you work at the UN. And he said to me with my head held high, and I thought, now there's a different perspective. And he was, and I agree with him now, 10 years into this job. He said, until and unless we work there, until they get to know us as people, until we break down every stereotype that exists for the people who are marching in and out of that building, he said, until we let them no longer do this to us, nothing's going to change. And I'm really proud to be the Jew at the UN. I am really proud that the executive director of UNICEF International is a Jew by choice. I can't tell you that I'm not sometimes in a room where I hear what I really don't want to hear. And at the same time, I think that's why I'm there. It's important that we do hear what we don't want to hear, because otherwise we're not going to be able to refute it. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you I don't think there's any bias. I'm not going to sit here and tell you I think everything the UN does is right. But I am going to tell you I am really proud to represent UNICEF, and that UNICEF could not do its work without the UN, because UNICEF works upstream and downstream. We don't just build a school, we make sure school fees are waived. We don't just immunize, we get a war stop to get an immunization campaign through. We are dealing with every child, and you can't do that without government support.
Great, thank you. Jenny, similarly, you talked about the vigils last week, and Hias has played an incredible leadership role around the civil war in Syria and around resettlement of Syrian refugees in this country. I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about how you've navigated what I'm sure are complex waters with the American Jewish community around resettling Muslims and Arabs in this country and the challenges around that, and also navigating relationship with Israel vis-a-vis the war in Syria.
So I would say that the vast majority of American Jews want to welcome refugees to this country of all ethnic and religious backgrounds. And about 50% of the refugees who are resettled in America are Muslim, many from Arab countries, though not all. There are pockets in the Jewish community, for sure, who are either mamash resistant or feel like they should be supportive, but have a lot of concerns and have a kind of feeling of discomfort around it. So we spend a lot of time sort of navigating these waters. I think there are a few things that we really try to lift up, and we really see our role almost as trying to help the Jewish community find its way to living its values and history, which sometimes means working through some of these other reactions. So one is refugees coming to this country, the last thing on their mind is the Jews. I know we like to think it's all about the Jews. That they're not thinking about Jews. They're thinking about, how do I keep my family safe? Are we going to get to a safe place? Am I going to be able to make a life in this new place? On an anecdotal level, or I would say maybe a on-the-ground level, we actually are seeing that a lot of Syrian refugees, a lot of our clients, are coming having been raised with anti-Semitic propaganda. It's true. However, what we're also finding is when they come and they are being resettled by Jews and by Jewish agencies, they're being picked up at the airport by Hias and their local JFS. They are the person who's helping them enroll their kids in school, and the family that is helping to welcome them, and the synagogue that is there, you know, the person they call. In fact, one of our clients said, you know, who did I call at 5 a.m. when I couldn't get the stove to work? It was a Jew. And it's really changing my understanding. Like, I was raised to think all these terrible things about Jews, and yet you were the ones there helping us. So, and we see this across the country, both with folks Hias is resettling and ones that other agencies are resettling, but synagogues and Jewish communities are embracing. So I think we have an opportunity here to actually rewrite some of the narrative. And there's also a lot of interfaith Jewish-Muslim partnership on an organizational and communal level going on. I think the fact that there are so many Israeli NGOs that are working with Syrian refugees is actually extremely helpful beyond the work that you're doing, because, you know, there's sort of a, like, if Israel can do it, kal vachomer, the American Jewish community should be able to do it. And I just learned actually yesterday that the Religious Zionist Rabbinic Associate Organization, Beit Hillel, just issued a halachic essay about the obligation to help Syrian refugees. And it's this complex text of like halachic debate, and they're actually both female and male halachic authorities sort of debating this. And where they conclude is that we have a moral obligation to help innocent lives, even if they're enemies of the state. And I think that that's, you know, another piece. And then finally, who do we want to be, right? Do we want to be a people that says, you're not welcome in our country because of what you believe? Is that who we want to be as Jews? And is that who we want to be as Americans? And I think of MLK, you know, who says you don't fight hate with hate. You fight it with love. You don't fight darkness with darkness. You fight it with light. And this is really a question about the soul of who we are as a people. And I think that that is really collectively sort of the ways that we forge a path through. And we've seen a lot of people in the American Jewish community evolve around this.
Great. So bridging out a little bit from the Jewish community and thinking about the American, and I recognize, again, this is American-centric, but I think it has implications more broadly, both because of America's role and because of the way America is right now. I don't think it's a bold thing to say that refugee and immigrant issues in this country have become somewhat politicized in the last, you know. I had the list of things I was going to cite, but I'm not going to cite all of them because you know what they are, right? And I think the only one I'll say is Iowa Representative Steve King saying we can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies, right? So these issues, which could be apolitical, have become highly politicized. And I'm curious about how each of you respond to the charge that, no, it's too political to have to work on that now or to be engaged around that. So, Carol, you want to go?
Well, first of all, I try really hard to point out to people who say that to me that there is absolutely nothing political about saving the life of a child. You know, children are the victims of the politics of adults. They have no politics. We don't get to pick where we're born or what religion we're born into. If we did, we wouldn't pick poverty. We wouldn't pick a war zone. We wouldn't pick a country where they're blowing up our homes and we're forced to flee. So the idea that these children should be held accountable for anything other than the fact that they exist is unacceptable to me. So I usually try and start there. For those who are pretty staunch, and there are a lot of them in our country at the moment, you know, I would go back to something that you referenced earlier. What's the best way, really, to prove to someone that we're not what they think we are, or to prove to protect our own security? Save the life of someone's child. You know, if you save someone's child, do you really think they're coming after you? That is the best way. And that also, right now, in addition to the number of refugees in general, there are 50 million kids, seriously, 50 million children at the moment on the move, literally not in their homes tonight, 28 million of them forcibly removed. So that means they're sleeping on rocks, not in a bed tonight. And if we don't do something for these kids, if we don't educate these kids, they will have no ideology other than the ideology of hate. They will only have experienced extreme violence in their lives. And we have an opportunity to save a generation or to be the victims of what that generation becomes. So if I'm really forced into it, I'll go there.
So highest refugee issues for a long time were nonpartisan, like a long time until a few months ago. And Hayes has always partnered with the government and seen the government through all the administrations as our partner, because the way that refugee resettlement works in this country, it's a private-public partnership. And so the NGOs partner with the U.S. government. So we've always done advocacy to a government that has also been our partner. So this all changed recently. And for the first time in Hyas's 136 years, we are actually pursuing litigation. And we are suing the Trump administration. We're the main, one of the main plaintiffs on the Maryland case that some of you may be familiar with. I have to tell you, this was not an easy decision for our board, because it is, we've always been political, and this is taking us political one step further. And frankly, it's risky, because we are very dependent, not just on private funding, but the majority of our money is either from the State Department or from UNHCR, who's the main contributor to UNHCR, the United States government. And we have reason to believe that we also may have a somewhat vindictive administration. So it was a high-risk endeavor for the organization. And there was a several-hour call on a Sunday morning. And I'm proud to say that our board decided, you know what, at this moment in history, we need to use every tool in our toolkit. So now we're not only doing sort of traditional advocacy and grassroots advocacy, but we're also using litigation. So tune in the coming weeks. We'll be hearing, you know, what's going on with the Supreme Court case.
Carol, I want to follow up a little bit on what you were saying related to this, which is, obviously there are both the child as victim who is in need of direct service, but also the upstream causes, right? The root causes that lead to those situations. And how do you and UNICEF navigate the differentiation? Because the solutions to upstream causes are almost always complicated, right? Political or policy related, at least. And I'm curious about how you thread that complicated needle in this context.
So similar to Hyas, we partner with government. Always. You know, we won't build a school if the government isn't going to waive the school fee, isn't going to ensure there's a teacher there, isn't going to maintain that the books and other materials show no bias. I mean, there's a variety of technical things, and that's just one example. So, or in Guatemala, where I worked last summer, we are not only providing service to girls who have been victimized by the violence in Guatemala, but we are addressing and working with the government on the root causes of the violence. So, you know, we do work with government, and at the same time, we work on both sides of every battle. So we try really hard to have no politics. Again, the only side we're on is the side of the child. And that's critical, because as I said, when we're trying to deal with, when I went back to Darfur, the first day I was in Darfur, I spent hours with the Darfurian government, because we were trying to set up, you know, the water trail, you know, and it wasn't me bringing the water, obviously it was the team in Darfur, but we met with Darfurian government, and the next day we met with Janjaweed leaders, because at the end of the day, the safety and security of those trucking water from one point to the other point depended on having support from both, and so that's our intersection overwhelmingly with government. At the same time, that doesn't mean we don't make our voices and our opinions known. You know, in late April, I had 500 of our biggest supporters and donors a day on the Hill. We did 196 meetings in one day on both sides of the aisle, thanking those who were supporting us, demanding more from those who weren't, and reminding them that these are children, and that the children are not defined by borders. So these are not Syria's children or Guatemala's children. They are just children, and we are grown-ups. And until we can get people to start differentiating on that line, we're not going to solve the problem.
This is Global Torah Live. I'm Shani Rosenbaum. You're listening to Aaron Dorfman, Jenny Rosen, and Carol Stern discuss how we talk about global challenges in Jewish communities in 2017.
So to pivot a little bit from the policy and the political arena to the personal, a lot of the conversation, certainly over the last day, has been around how to elevate attention, how to expand the universe of obligation in the global Jewish community to include children, refugees, immigrants in other places, so that, you know, in answer to Rabbi Sacks' assertion, the Jewish community considers more people within its universe of obligation. So I'm curious to hear from both of you about how you and your organizations have learned to do that most effectively. Right, especially in this era in which people are increasingly internally focused, local problems, local issues, American inward looking. In our case, Brexit. Well, I mean, I think that's not an uncommon thing, and pushing people to think beyond seems increasingly challenging.
So, On September 3rd of 2015, something phenomenal happened, which is that there was an iconic photograph published of Ayan Kurdi, the three-year-old boy whose body washed up on the Turkish shore. And this came after a summer of seeing, bodies, seeing the Rohingya, dying on boats, seeing refugees on trains trying to cross borders, which is particularly resonant for Jews. And then this photograph was published. And I think about this as like that the famous photograph from the Vietnam War of the girl running. Like, this is an iconic photograph that broke open people's hearts and minds and opened people's eyes. And it happened right around the high holidays. And the media, I think, has been played a phenomenal role. A lot of things you can say about the media, I think, in this moment, played a phenomenal role of catapulting Americans and American Jews out of their bubbles. And so a lot of our work has been, people woke up. And so our work is, how do we educate them? How do we energize them? How do we mobilize them? How do we give them tachlis things to do? And how do we sustain that attention? I think this election, the only silver lining I would say to this election, is that it has given an added urgency to people. And we're seeing, I would say, people who were afraid to go too far. We often will talk to rabbis who, before the election, we had a lot of rabbis. We have about 2,000 rabbis who signed on to a statement that we then used with all the members of Congress. After the election, rabbis who were sort of on the fence, didn't want to be political, they feel like this is a moment where what's at stake is not politics, it's Jewish values. And so giving support and tools to those leaders to really take bolder stands.
Carol?
It's interesting, because I think the media catapulted but hasn't done enough. I really do, and I actually, the day that the picture of Elan came up, we had a great surge of American concern. 48 hours later, we didn't have a great surge of American concern. But I did call Arthur Sulzberger that day and thank him for putting the picture on the front page of the Times. And he told me they had been keeping score. He got more hate mail than positive mail on that picture. So one thing I will say to all of you is, if you think the press should be reporting and showing you things, you need to sometimes take the moment to write them and say thank you, because they need to hear that, because they will hear from those who object. But there was a famine about 4 or 5 years ago in the Horn of Africa. And I just couldn't get anybody to pay attention to the fact that there was a famine. It's like, we have famine fatigue, So I called Arthur Sulzberger and I yelled at him, and I said, there are children dying and I can't believe you're not running. This should be top of the fold, you should be screaming about this. Kids are dying for lack of something to eat. And so he sent a reporter and I yelled loud. We got a reporter and he did about a 2-hour interview with me, and I did get one sentence in the article. The sentence that I got was, how loud do I have to yell? What mountain do I have to stand on? How loud do I have to yell to get Americans to just wake up and see children are dying for lack of what I'm throwing away every night? And so about 2 days later, I get a phone call in my office with somebody who ready to answer it. My secretary comes in and she says, there's somebody from Buckingham Palace on your phone. Now, my friend Mark always calls and says that he's Bruce Springsteen, so I just assumed it was Mark, But it really was Buckingham Palace, and William and Kate had just gotten married, and they agreed that they would help us draw attention to the famine by going with us to our warehouse in Copenhagen and bringing their press corps, and they would help us actually pack the supplies we needed. And I got the privilege to go with them and do that. And it was amazing how, when the prince and princess packed supplies, the people of the UK got on board and sustained being on board for that famine. Well, we have a famine going on right now while we're sitting here. And it's not on the front page. I probably should call Arthur and yell again. But there, it's not, we're going about our business because we have this privilege to do that. And it's a really interesting dichotomy to me, because I used to say to my mother all the time, when I was a little kid, Mom, how could the world let that happen? And she would say, well, people claimed, with quotes, claimed they didn't know. Well, we can't even claim we don't know. We do know. It's right in front of us. It's online. We're seeing it in real time. It may not be on the front page of the Times every day, but we do know it's happening. I saw many nods there were when I said there's a famine going on right now, but we somehow have the ability to just not focus on it. So my challenge is to get you to focus, and I will do anything I need to get you to focus on it. I will bring in whatever celebrity I can get my hands on, whatever sports or athlete I can get my hands on, whatever politician wants to speak up, whatever mother wants to tell you the story, but we have got to get you away from this big number that feels so big down to the story of one person, because we all respond to one person. And you know, I will tell you, for me, that happened in that last famine, because I did go pack all the supplies, and then we put all the supplies on a 747, thanks to BA, and we flew it to Kenya, and then we unpacked it with forklifts, and we put it into little planes, and we flew it up to Kakuma, where the heart of the famine was. And I had Cynthia McFadden with me to film it so that we could show this. She was at Nightline at the time. So I had her and a cameraman, and they decided, we've been now up for like 30 hours, and we've driven for hours, and we haven't seen anybody, and they need B-roll of the desert, so we pull over for them to get B-roll of the desert, like you're feeling like an idiot. And I'm standing in the hot sun, and I hear a noise, and I turn around, and there's a woman there. And she's like standing on the top of this big hill, and she is so emaciated, I can't tell how old she is. And she's holding the hand of a child, and I have no idea how old the child is, because when kids are stunted, this child could have been 8 years old, this child could have been 16. I have no idea. And she was as scared as I was when we kind of found each other, because we were in the middle of nowhere. And she backed up and I backed up, and you could just tell, like, one wrong move and she's coming after me, you know? And then she kind of loosened up a little and she rubbed her belly and she put her hand out. And it was clear what she wanted, why she was wandering the desert. She was looking for something to eat. You know, and the only thing I had it with me was an apple in a backpack, and I tossed her the apple, and she took the apple, and she bowed. You know, like, this was like the greatest gift in the world, and she walked away. And I think about that all the time. You know, I think about, like, why didn't I run after her? Why didn't I make sure she had food for tomorrow? Like, it just happened. But I also think about it because I do have an apple in my backpack, and you have an apple in your backpack, and so my biggest job is to make you realize you have an apple in your backpack and to get you to share it. And I think that it's really doable. And I think in our community, as I said at the beginning, we did stand up and say never again. We did. And we didn't say never again for Jews. We said never again. And I think we do have that moral sense, you know, in our Jewish neshama, that we're going to stand up and we're going to do something. And we just sometimes have to be asked. And that's the challenge, is to get in the right place to do the asking. You know, if you do nothing else after this panel today, but go back and ask one person who's not doing anything to do something, I will have felt I had a really worthwhile afternoon. Because we have got to wake up and act now, or these children are going to die for lack of something to eat in the year 2017. And that's unconscionable.
Erin, I want to follow up on the question about the Jewish community.
Yeah.
Because I think there are three parts to it. One is that the Jewish community has and does at this time often focus in on itself. And I think that as a community of NGOs and leaders doing international work, you know, in a Jewish context, we have to be lifting up, and we all do this, but even more so, sort of the framework of Jewish values and why this is actually about who we are as a people. This is not some extra thing we do. This is not just humanitarian values with Judaism pasted on. You know, this is core to who we are as a people and what we're called to do at this time. And I think that that is critical. I think that there's also a real focus in the United States on domestic, and I think this is probably true in Britain, and this is probably true in Israel. Like, we all have internal crises to our nation. And so I think making the connection between that and what's going on internationally is really important. People know we're global citizens because of the, you know, the way that the social media and media works. Like, we are exposed to it all the time, but really making that connection that those people who are in your community, like in America, the refugees who are coming have family that are still there, have stories to tell about there, to help people make that link. And then finally, people need things to do. I think that there is more than we have people to convert. We have people who are with us, but not engaged, or with us, but not mobilized. And so there's always this question, do we go after the people who we need to convince? Yes. But I would say in the Jewish community, there are a lot of people who are with us, but not mobilized. And so it's upon us to really figure out what are the ways that we give them ways to act, because it's really something that they are hungry for.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm conscious of the time. I want to get a couple of voices. So let's do a round of like two or three or four questions, and then get some answers, and then we'll close.
I wanted to know if there is a connection between HIAS and UNICEF, if you're doing something with early childhood.
I know that we're working together with the refugees who have been resettled in New Jersey. And I also know we're working together closely in San Diego, similarly with the refugees, the Syrian refugees who are being resettled in San Diego.
That's right. Yeah, I don't know internationally.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Internationally, I believe we are working, actually, there is a project, but I'm trying to remember which country I was reading about. I think Uganda. Yeah, I think it's Uganda.
Hi, I'm Matthew from Tel Aviv Tzedek. We have a lot of urgency in our present time, but we also have a very ominous future with climate change. And I was wondering, there's projections that are very contentious in their estimates, but anywhere from 200 million to a billion future refugees that are displaced from their environment due to sea level rise, natural disasters by 2050. Which is 33 years from now, and we're having a lot of challenges in our present time. So I was wondering if there are strategic or long-term efforts that are addressing the future as well as the present.
So obviously the UN is addressing the issue of climate change, but in terms of UNICEF, we have very much first looked internally, how do we green ourselves and make our cold chain as as clean as it possibly can be. Looking everything from not using paper to probably the most recent examples in the Zaatari camp, where which is was built originally for 20,000 people in Jordan. It now has over 100,000 refugees living in it. Initially, we were trucking in water, which was like the least green way to do anything because the amount of fuel it was taking to bring the water in. So then we ultimately did put in a water system, but recognizing that it's going to be there for a very long time. We now have put in a water treatment plant. So the dirty water from the camp is being converted to gray water, being given to the farmers in the host community. And we're actually transforming the host community more rapidly, I think, than we are those in the camp at the moment as a result. So we are trying to look at long-term sustainable issues. We're also looking at what happens to children who are dependent on the climate now. So for example, in Kenya, in Kakuma, where the majority of the people in that region were nomadic, you have kids who never go to school because they're constantly moving with their parents with the herd. And we're always troubled by what happens when they no longer can do that. And so we actually put teachers into the tribes who move with the herds. So the kids are learning. And when I was up in Kakuma, the most amazing thing was you see this little lean-to and the kids are studying, but you see the grannies on one side and the elders on the other side, and they're teaching themselves listening to the teacher. So we're trying to change the way people will think about sustaining themselves.
So refugee NGOs work generally, and HIAS is included, within the framework of the legal definition of a refugee. And the whole concept of a refugee came actually out of the ashes of the Shoah. The 1951 Refugee Convention grew out of countries coming together and saying, we can never again send people back to the countries of persecution. And so 148 countries, including Israel, the United States, a lot of European countries, signed on to the declaration, the Refugee Convention. And it defines a refugee as someone who is fleeing persecution based on one of five things: religion, nationality, race, political opinion, and social group. Social group would be like LGBT. And so you actually, for someone, you get refugee status, it's a legal status. And environment is not in that. People use refugee, environmental refugee, climate refugee colloquially, but it's not in the legal framework. And so I think that limits, in some ways, the attention that it's getting and certain the services that it's getting. And the I think this is a big question for the refugee sort of NGO sector, is how to integrate this, what will be millions and millions of climate refugees.
Other questions? Yeah, in the back.
Hi, my name's Hilly. I was wondering, it was really interesting to see that you mentioned putting technology in an area where there was need for water. And I was wondering, A, how you source the technologies for your efforts and projects, and B, what role does technology in general play in all the efforts?
So the sourcing, UNICEF is one of the largest purveyors of everything children need. You know, we actually vaccinate more than 50% of the world's children right now. We have warehouses pre-positioned around the world. And so the purveying part of it, I couldn't even begin to tell you. There is a director of supply, and that is her role, and she really deals with who we buy from and why. But it is always open bidding, et cetera. But beyond that, I really couldn't tell you, sorry. But in terms of the role technology plays, it plays a very big role in what we do. Everything from conversion to solar power for a lot, because there is sun, but there isn't always electricity everywhere we go. Looking at things like Plumpy Nut, which is the response to malnutrition, and it's a peanut butter paste, which was an amazing innovation. We have a huge innovation group at UNICEF whose job it is just to think about how we change what we're doing. The program I'm most excited about here in the United States that had technology is a campaign, and I'm embarrassed because I'm not wearing mine, called Kid Power. One in four American children has been technically labeled underactive, which is why there's such a large amount of obesity as well as heart disease. It's the first generation whose lifespan is predicted to be shorter than their parents. I think you probably all know that. Okay, simultaneous to that, one in four kids around the world is malnourished. If we do nothing, they will die. So I sat at my desk with the one in four and one in four, and I turned to the innovation group and said, there's something in there. You know, one in four, I'm not brilliant, you're brilliant, come back with an idea. And they created Kid Power. And at the heart of it, they developed a low-cost fitness band. It's given to kids in Title I schools. They're challenged to walk 12,500 steps a day, which is the U.S. recommended number. For every 2,500 steps they walk, they earn a point, and it lights up, and it buzzes, and it's a very cool moment. For every 10 points that they earn, we release a sachet of ready-to-use therapeutic food to a starving child, thanks to our underwriters. So the motivation to the American kid is, if you get healthy, you will save a life. We could not get any company to produce those bands for us, so we had to do a startup in-house and do it ourselves. Disney and Lucasfilms underwrote the campaign to get the first kids in the program. Target stores said they would sell the band online, but it probably wouldn't be a very big seller because we were going to have to compete with Fitbit. Pink became the spokesperson. This speaks to your point about how do I get out there. She went on Good Morning America. Target sold out their complete supply in 4 hours. We're now in all 150 stores. To date, there are 200,000 kids now in the program, and the goal is 10 million. We did a study, and we proved that we had a control group that got the bands but no motivation. And then those who got the motivation, the kids who were motivated are 55% more active than the kids who are not. And so our goal is to get 10 million American kids saving the lives of children around the world. To date, the 200,000 kids have now saved the lives, seriously, of 40,000 children around the world. It's been remarkable. And we're only in our second year.
So we are at time, but I do want to give Jenny and Carol a last word, and the only point I'd put on the last word is that you've got a room full of influencers and key opinion leaders here, and I'd encourage you to give them a takeaway to bring back to wherever they're going, if you've got. Jenny, you want to start?
So I would say that there are four ways that we think about, and that I would encourage you to think about what we're mobilizing people to do. Educate. I think that there's so much misinformation, and that fuels hate. And I think the way that we can educate our friends and family, which are often the most difficult people, people who may have different perspectives than us, certainly around refugee issues, but other issues as well. Advocacy is the most important thing in the American context, for sure, and I don't think it's so different necessarily. I mean, it's different, but I don't think that that is not also true in Europe and Israel. And that's advocacy both government-facing and in the public square. And amplify your voice. So important to, and we're seeing certainly in America that that is making a difference. And this is a moment where taking to the streets and amplifying one's voice and op-eds and public displays really matter. The third is creating more welcoming communities. And the way that, you know, Jews are working here to create more welcoming communities for refugees, I think is true in everyone's community. And the ways that the Jewish community can really play a role. If you could imagine what it's like to arrive as a Muslim refugee right now in America, what the climate is like. And I think the Jewish community has a role to play. And then the fourth is tzedakah, which I don't need to tell, you know, everyone in this room how important that is. A lot of organizations now, you know, that rely on government funding at a time when it's more needed than ever, it's more at risk. It's more at risk than ever. And I would just close by saying, you know, I think that we're at a historic moment. We're at a historic moment not only because there are more refugees and displaced people than ever in recorded history. If I'd sat here last year, I would have said since World War II. We're now since ever in recorded history. But we're also at a historic moment because it's the first time that we as Jews are not refugees. The first time. But instead in a position to make a difference for today's refugees. And I would say broadening that beyond refugees, we are at a point of more affluence and influence than ever in our history as a people. And I think that we have a very important and unique role to play. And I would even say, you know, this is our Esther moment. And at a time when we can, at this moment in history, take people who have woken up. People are awake. But they need to be sustained, and they need to be mobilized, and they need to be have their energies channeled so that we can really ensure that people are having their basic human rights met, that people are having their basic human needs met, and that they're able to thrive and live lives with kavod, with dignity.
Thank you, Jenny. Carol.
Ditto. You know, beautifully said. I guess I would only add to it that I think educate is a really big piece of it. I think it's really important that we do open our eyes and we do pay attention to what is going on in the world, and that we use our voices to make sure others do the same, and that we raise the next generation to solve the problems we're going to leave behind. You know, I always say I wish I could live long enough to see the problem of child survival solved. I don't anticipate that's going to happen, but the best thing I can do is invest in those who might solve it after me. So this is not a commercial for UNICEF. I don't care what child agency you give it to, but give it to somebody. And that could be your time, that could be your energy, that could be your voice, that could be your wallet. That could be any of the aforementioned. You know, when I last was in the Zaatari camp, we start work very, very early in the morning in a camp, and you work all day and you don't even realize that you don't stop. And there's always children who glom onto you. I always say working with kids is learning to do the elephant walk. You've always got kids attached to like every part of your body. But there's always kids who kind of walk behind you and they don't touch you, and they're the shy kid. You know, I'm sure you've experienced it. You turn around real quick and they turn around real quick. They don't make eye contact, you know. And that last day in the camp, there was this little boy who walked behind me all day. He was about 4. And with him was a girl who I later learned was his sister. She was about 12. She was carrying another sibling, a baby, all day. And they were there when we started work at 5 o'clock in the morning. And they were with us at the end of the day at 6 o'clock when we were getting ready to leave the camp. And one of my team said, you know, we never ate today. And we realized we had never even had a cup of coffee. Like, we had just gone right to work. And it dawned on us, if we didn't eat, the kids didn't eat. And this little boy had been with me all day long. So you realize that this kid never eats, probably, because he didn't complain. He never asked, where's my food? You know, I don't know how many of you have kids, but I have 3 sons. I know what it's like in my house if there's nothing on the table. So we were kind of struck by that. And at one point, I had worked in a breastfeeding tent, and we had been giving the women these biscuits, you know, that have micronutrients in it. And they had given me the biscuit. And I'm trying to lose weight, so I don't eat carbs. So I had, like, palmed my biscuit, you know. And so we gave the biscuit to this little boy and expected him to run off and gobble it. And he just first kind of looked at us like, who are you people, you know. But he opened it up, and the first thing he did was he broke it in half, and he handed half to the baby. And this is a child who didn't eat all day, and he knew enough to give half to the baby. So My message is give half to the baby. You know, that we all have an opportunity to give something. If you're a poet, write about it. If you're an artist, paint about it. If you are, you know, a journalist, get the word out. You know, that there's some way you can take something that you have and use it for the betterment of the generation that's going to follow. And that is at the heart of who and what we are as a people.
And that's today's conversation. You can hear more Global Torah live on iTunes, Stitcher, or at olamtogether.org. Global Torah was created by Olam and the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. Special thanks to Ben Wallach, Seth Samuel, the Olam team, and to today's featured guests, Aaron Dorfman, Carol Stern, and Rabbi Jenny Rosen. Olam is a joint venture of the Alliance for Global Good, Charles and Lynn Schusterman Family Foundation, and Paris Foundation. Learn more at olamtogether.org.